the second part of the interview with General Ellis Williamson by William Burr took place on March 11, 1988.
Chief of Army Medic in 1971. But before you left for Iran, were you given briefings on American policy by State Department or other officials? Did you have policy briefings?
Yes. To some extent, we were well fought. I was appointed to the position, and then the situation that didn't apply to me at all caused a delay of my going over there for some 3 months. I made a special study for the Secretary of Defense in the field of my previous job. So I was here in the States 3 months after I had finished the regular job that I was on and had a fair amount of time. During that period of time, I attended a State Department. They call it a school. It was more of a seminar, as I recall, it was about 3 or 4 weeks for their foreign service officers. So I found that extremely interesting and informative. I had quite detailed briefings by the State Department, Secretary of Defense, each of the military services in the CIA. So I think I went over reasonably well prepared to enter a new job. One point of interest that, and my main thesis in working with you is trying to help us understand the Persian culture and the Persian mindset, my culture. In almost every briefing I had in the Washington area, the subject of the intelligence of the Shah came up. But the Shah was the kingpin who personified everything that happened in Iran. And I was invariably told what a smart, brilliant man he was. So I went over almost with a chip on my shoulder. My thought was, good God, he ought to look smart. He's been king for 35 years. And if anybody talks on a subject he doesn't understand, all he has to do is change the subject. So I went over feeling that this man, really, he's come to war. He can't be as intelligent. He can't be as smart as the entire population seems to believe over here. I hadn't been over there 2 months before. I was a total convert. I was thoroughly convinced that that man probably had the most comprehensive mind I've ever dealt with. You could tell him something, he could understand it, he could remember it, and he could recall it any time he wanted, in almost any language. And that's another subject. But I met with him on a one-to-one basis, time and time again. He could recall dates when we talked. He could recall just what we said without any hesitation at all. More so than any individual I've ever dealt with. So I want us to think a good bit on the Persian mind and how it works a little bit. We'll get to that on another subject.
Now, when you were giving these briefings back in 71, the people who you met with, they talk about how the importance of Iran to America and interest at that time, was that defined in some way? Why Iran was to be important to America in economic or strategic interest? How was interest defined or characterized?
Quite a few people that briefed me felt that they needed to give me a complete history but that's part of the world, and I found it quite impossible. And there's no question in my mind that that part of the world was critical to our people felt. It was critical to our security principle, of course, but then this same location, the land mass, as you call in War II, the territory, the land of Iran, was essential to the prosecution of World War II. It became a supply line right into the southern portion of the private Russian portion. And as you recall, when the communists first got going, they considered Iran as the Suez of that area, the route to India, the land route. No question in anybody's mind of what Iran and civilization for the things that were of great importance to us. There was a debate going on at that time, it continued for several years, as to the feasibility of Iran's armed forces being modernized and developed and enlarged as much and as rapidly as they were. And I could find a new answer almost anywhere I stopped. Most everybody has a personal opinion on that. It's not like Nick and Mark, because everybody knows an answer, but us people don't agree with. So I got quite a few different feedbacks with respect to what we as a nation should be doing to assist Iran in their approach to the armed forces. But I got a very good confidence.
Now, at this time, the U.S. had intelligence facilities, what they called, they were located in northern Iran, used to monitor missile tests and so forth in the Soviet Union. How important were they considered to be?
They were completely outside of my official responsibility. I had knowledge that they were there. I had the administrative support requirements for the individuals that were there. They were well into the mountains, out of my geographical area most of the time, but as they came down from the hills, as we would call it, they would come to our area. We would give them administrative support. We even sent doctors. I had a little hospital over there. They had, I think, three of their own doctors, and they had to rotate in and out of the mountainous area. So when their doctors were back on the so-called rotation, they worked in my hospital. So I did have a good many contacts with them, but nothing as far as subject matter. I never saw a message that they received or dispatched, or they did frequently use my facility. I never, in the time I was there, there was a hard and fast rule that I got when I left this country. Your mission is not important. You will not initiate. You will not participate in any intelligence activities. Intelligence gathering activities, I can say. The subject came up time and time again. I adhered to my guidance at all times. I was invited, in fact, I was a strong movement to use my personnel at times as cover. In other words, they wanted to take an agent assigning to me one of my positions and let me operate on the intelligence field. I turned that down every time because my guidance were to stay out of that field. To the best of my knowledge, no agent of any intelligence activity was ever assigned my hand. That was my hard and fast rule. I had to stay out of it. Now, as I mentioned before we turned the machine on, there was no question of what I was an American person. And if anything came up that I thought my government should know, it went right back. That developed into a routine that was somewhat divisive as it went on, and that quite frequently the Shah wanted something known in the United States. But he recognized that if he put it through sovereign government to sovereign government, direct communication, it would cause problems. Sometimes if he had a question, he couldn't very well personally ask that question of President Nixon. He couldn't put it on that level. If he talked with the ambassador, it was the equivalent of sovereign government to sovereign government. But he could talk to me as the chief of the military mission. And in addition to that assignment, along with that assignment, I was listed as the personal advisor to the Shah. So he could talk to me. He could tell me things, knowing full well that I was going to report.
Give an example of one of those.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You remember the little islands, that three little islands right at the strait, right at the Hormuz Strait. Those little islands became a bone of contention, I think it was in late 71 or early 72 along in there. And Iran decided, we're going to settle this, we're just going to go occupy them and that'll be the end of it. The Shah told me personally the day before the operation was stopped. I reported it within the hour. By the time I left the palace, I went right back to my headquarters, around radio, it was in the United States, and nothing happened. So the U.S. knew that the next morning at daylight, the landings were going to be made on this field. He didn't want to handle that through the government to government top level basis. But he didn't want our government to feel that he was holding in wrong or fasting without keeping him in front. That was a very interesting operation, too. It carried on with a few ships standing off for gun support if it's needed. But the landings were made with these hydrofoils, the zero gravity across the water vehicles. They informed the local people the afternoon before the people come. An hour before the landing, they flew airplanes over with loudspeakers saying, we are coming in, we hope we are welcome. There was one casualty. One Iran Army lieutenant was shot and killed by a policeman that hadn't gotten away. But other than that, that was the only casualty. And the mayor of the little town on the biggest island had had his people prepare breakfast for him. So that's the way the operation went on. But there was not a public announcement in advance to his coming. But our government knew it about 36 hours, 24 hours before that. And it was handled through that channel, first and first.
Both things happen quite a bit, that kind of use.
Not too often.
No.
Not too often, but and not on that magnitude. Most of the things that came up were outside the military. In other words, he would very frequently discuss agriculture down to the side, how he wanted to figure in ways to increase production. One of the real examples of success, they magnified their production of vegetable down terrifically. But he discussed it with me. I'm not a farmer, I'm not a country boy, but I just living in an industrialized country exposed me to osmosis and all of that. So I could help him think. I could ask him questions, and you can see this, and you can see that. And But we talked about the agriculture through the time. We talked about the fisheries that were on. There's been something else. We talked about the electrical engines for water supply and Jabahar. All kinds of subjects that he could ask me. I could go back to the embassy or I could send a message back to the U.S. and get an informal, informational set of facts that were priceless to him. But if it had to go through the mechanism, it would have to get cleared through a bunch of layers, several layers of the organization here and there. But he used me just literally as a mouthful.
Now, when you became Army Staff Chief, this is toward the end of the first term of the next administration, how would you characterize the administration's general approach towards Iran, you know, around that time?
So, when I first went over there, my briefing in the state had told me that some individuals were questioning what we were doing in Iran, going on the time. But in general, my view was we are 100% behind Iran. We are friends. Iran is our friends of ours. We are getting along really well together. And I saw that at every time. If I had seen this criticism, it would have been violence. But the Iranians trusted us, I thought, too much. I studied my lesson very hard because I knew darn well that everything I told them, they were going to take it face value, believe me, 100%. So I had to be quite careful not to give them an off-the-cuff answer to something that I thought maybe was wrong. But they trusted, particularly the military, much more so than the embassy. They would ask us questions, and if we told them the answer, it was never the slightest question of whether it was right or not. We said so. It was somewhat embarrassing. As time went on, and as you recall, President Nixon visited over there, the President said, a real interesting experience. Lots of Alaskans testified to what I had wanted to have. It was quite an affair. They were the delighted to have me come.
That's only a few months after you arrived, actually. Maybe 6 months.
About. Maybe a little longer. I'm not sure. But
May of 72.
May of 72, yeah. Maybe we're talking about 3 months. So, there was quite an entourage set up to come over for that visit. As you recall, they had been in Moscow, and they came from Moscow to Iran. And we had just had an ambassador retire. A new ambassador was rushed over. Everything was set up. Party. Many, many messages went back and forth to him. One load after one load of equipment. Hospital was practically completely renovated. It's a big fund. They call it a hospital, actually. It was a pretty good dispensary, but it wasn't. It was a very small hospital. Our operating room was cleaned up, and new equipment was put in, and everything was set up, and the patient room was on. We were good shape. All the things were set up for that. Communication was just great. We were in time for the party came in. I went very interesting experience. The Russian ambassador was, as they call it, I borrowed a souvenir ambassador. And I associated with the school called socially. And as a rule, I can tell if someone can understand English, even a little bit, just by looking in their eyes. But this man was a technique with blank space. And so his interpreter translating that English, he showed no response to anything. When the group was assembling for the president's arrival, they were assembling in the Imperial Palace, reception palace there at the airport. The Russian ambassador, and initially one in front of him, he insisted on being right in the red dress. He came rushing across the room in perfect English. Oh, good morning, General Williamson. We must be friends. And I said, do you know of any reason why we shouldn't be friends? From then on, he spoke English. But until then, he never spoke a single word of English. But the president came on in. Everything went well. They had an entourage set up so that he would drive from the airport, not directly to the palace, but all through the city. And they had, I can't recall the shop leader, probably this case, 2.5 million along the street. But it was a mob of people. I was all right behind. People were stacked up. Started off, they were at curve. But as the convoy started through, the people came up and stood in very orderly manner, leaving one just long enough to go through. One of the policemen was closing around. But there were no armed guards, and no signs of military that started to go. Convoy goes through in this convertible, and they were waving at the crowd, and the president speaking to him and shaking a few people. And I thought the doctor just speaking at that rate, and he said, you will never, never know what a lift this is going to take. So if you just went in Moscow, they would have come to you in full boxes. But if there was any sign of a dissident feeling at that time, it just wasn't there. People just friendly to the assembly, and they were out there and getting them in this hot car.
Now, real quick, when did you meet with them? Did you
have a meeting with them? Yes, but the meetings with the Shah and the president were private. The Shah likes to do business on a one-to-one basis. And when he told President Nixon he wanted to talk to him alone, President Nixon just insisted that Mr. Kissinger come in. And John said, well, I want to talk with you. And Nixon said, well, I'd like to have Mr. Kissinger with me if you don't mind. John kind of answered, all right, let him come in and take notes. Kissinger went in, and to the best of my knowledge, it was just 3 hours in. But after the meeting, I got a rundown on President Nixon. And the next day, in the shop, as the president gave me a rundown, the ambassador and I said, well, I'll do that. And to the best of my knowledge, it was all three of them, they did some sort of just like me. That was.
Can you give a summary of what this was told as a pilot?
I guess the best way to say it is that you're just one of the top level, very, very friendly, very, very gentle impression. I'm giving you a few ideas of in discussion of the military. Right off the bat, understanding between them. No question of what nuclear weapons were out. Nobody, they weren't even going to bring up the subject. They weren't going to discuss nuclear weapons. But in the final analysis, there was a general understanding that anything the Shah wanted to buy, willing to pay for, if we were producing it, we could have it. In other words, Nixon let him know that I'm not holding anything back from you. I'm willing to support you 100% in anything that you feel you want. Now, let's digress just a little bit. At that time, I think I'm right. We were handling some kind of military contact in 147 different countries. So it was a pretty wide spread. We had mags in a good many countries, and we had military attachés. We had activities here and there, and we were putting the full spectrum from our co-equal association with the British and their scientific field to down to the least developed countries where we had to give them everything that they got on a grant basis. So there was a real broad spectrum of military type contacts between the U.S. and other countries. There was a feeling among the military assistance people, and I had previously had a previous job in the Secretary of Defense in the military assistance business for a long time. Among those people, the operators here in the United States, there was a strong feeling that we tell these other countries what they can have if we think it's appropriate for them, and okay. To try to work out that, either on a grant basis or sale basis or somewhere in between. In Iran, the Shah, when he had his 1971 coming out party, he said, we pay for everything. We don't ask for anything free from stuff. Very abnormal. It's around some problems. But because he was paying for it, he was paying full price for it, he, I believe rightfully, felt that he could select what he wanted to buy. There was a large element back in the United States that said, no, you need to tell him what you want. So there was a given to
him. Did you talk about the Pentagon?
State Department, most.
Yeah.
State Department has at least is intervening at least as much as Nixon said, if we are producing it and you want it and are willing to pay for it, you can have it. That went over like a lead balloon back then, to such an extent that I had to come back to the States, had a meeting with people here, there, and I said, finally, I said, now look, this is what our president said. This is the guidance that I have. If anyone wants to go to the president and get a change, do so. But please cooperate with me and support me instead of throwing all these roadblocks in the way.
What are the people that you're talking about?
what I have for the top people of each of the military assistance programs in the military departments on the Navy, Air Force, and Marine. With the representatives and CIA, I guess there were 35, 40 people in there. And, our approach, our military sales approach in Iran alone was bigger than all of the rest of the world put together.
You take all the
140, whatever it was, you can take all of those countries and put their entire purchases in a pot. And we still were bigger than all of them. So we were a little different. And we were vastly different in the land that none of it was grand. All of it was failure. So it was a little bit different. But the people back then didn't want to give up that influence. They felt that if we don't tell them what we're conditioned by, and if we don't select the school courses they take when they send us people, then we are losing some of our influence. And it was a running battle for some of us.
Why, when you have a picture kitchen after the meeting, they greet people, what's going on? Did they, either of them, think why this decision hasn't been made?
I don't think the president looked on it as a decision. The president looked on it as just a continuation of what we've been doing all along. He didn't feel that he had changed anything. Really didn't. But to show you how we work, you know, this district is with the president, the secretary, the president, and the right at the time, they were really going into a massive buildup, particularly in their army, and they wanted a lot more instructors for them. They wanted my military assistance team multiplied by factor 7. And our Congress had a ceiling, a worldwide ceiling, on the number of military people that could be assigned. Military assistance group. So, that meant
they were technicians.
No technicians, they were instructors, they were advisors. The Congress had decided we'd put a cap on the military assistance program. A lot of validity to that decision. But they put a ceiling, as I recall, it was just over the place. For a while. But we had them out in twos and threes and did that all around the world everywhere. And there was no way that we could even approach responding to the Iranian desires without wrecking the program everywhere else, all without getting some kind of sunshine that wouldn't work under the congressional mandate that we had at that time. So they were always going on. Well, the Iranians wanted 3,000 new military active duty people at each time. And they were beating about, well, President, you say we could have anything we want. I'm not sure you thought about people. You thought about the hardware then. But anyway, we looked at their list of their want list, shopping list of 3,000 people, and very quickly cut it down to 2,000. They really didn't need a commissary advisor. They didn't need a post exchange advisor.
2,000 was your recommendation.
Well, I didn't like it all, nothing more. We worked it down to 3,000, from 3 to 2,000, with the Iranians concurrent. The Iranians didn't have no desire to join at all. They were satisfied that they could do basically what they wanted to do. And just come down to 3,000. But then the party asked me what I thought was the target appropriate number.
executive branch, the party.
I'm not really sure where this is a meeting. We had a good many meetings here, but folks hold it and everybody else, and I'm not sure who's asking that question. I made a statement at that time, though, but I felt that we could get the number down to 1,000 and not offend their lines, not let them feel that we could pull the rug out from them. They'll feel a little bit. I didn't come to do that. That was just a guess on my part at that time.
And so when the party left, they went with the idea that we could hold it back.
They came back to Washington. That number was bounced around quite a bit. And then, as I say, I had to come back to Washington to do the thing. I get to what I call the dissonant elements in the federal headquarters, Chinese have a statement, if you're pulling weeds, be sure and get the roots. Well, I didn't get all the roots out. But it came down to that figure. And then finally, Secretary of the that really into a fight thing. And the only way we got around that, and incidentally, all these people that were coming over, they were run with the pay, all of their expenses. They were transportation over, all their household goods and their families, pay for the education of their children, for the housing, even pay into the military fund for the pension that the guy would be earning during the time he was over. And my wife didn't mind, I remember that a major, they were paying $360 a month into a pension fund so that the United States government would not be out any money at all. It cost us nothing. They pay for everything. The only way we got down below my 1,000, we never actually got to my 1,000 in a similar manner. We were working in that direction. We took one major segment out of the training. All of the Army aviation program was taken out of that and put into a civilian contract with Bell Helicopter. So in that way, the Army aviation program was set aside, and it went well above the 400 digits for my file. But it was set over to one side, and the Army paid to a civilian deal. And incidentally, they hired some U.S. military committees to oversee the watching the politics in that area, watching the Bell contract. But that was a civilian company kind of thing with that. So we got through that. The 600 were just about in country, as I defined. But the idea of President Nixon saying, if you want, you can have it, really stirred up a hundred snares to your point.
Even though he instituted the big decision, did you see the big change?
No. It wasn't a change.
Yeah.
It wasn't a decision. It was sure and simply say we are going to actually do what we've been saying. Now, as we went on, there were a few exceptions. I can't hear to read, I can't talk too much about the details of it, but there are some things that were non-nuclear that we were producing that we would have been extremely uncomfortable to let them get out of U.S. control because they were the terrorist-type weapons. Just that was small handheld anti-aircraft weapon. You could hold Dulles Airfield completely hostage to get two of us and the opposition. Or we knew the opposition. There are some things that we just don't want anybody else to have. We want to keep them under our rigid control. But by and large, we have told Sean that if you want one of our latest airplanes, one of our best tanks, one of our best pieces of munitions, something like that, you may have it if you're willing to pay for it. And of course, you have to wait for your turn in the production line, the production schedule. But if you want it, you have to.
Failed to be on the line to support a major buildup on the Radiant Force in the 70s. When you met with Nixon, Kissinger, Allen, and Nixon, President Nixon, and they're on the pilot meeting, did they explain to you why they thought that was important to support major buildup? What the U.S. broad U.S. strategy was in terms of a buildup in Iran? What the general purpose was?
They apparently went along 100% with the Shah's evaluation of the military requirements. Now, I think I went through this three-step thing where he said if he fought with a local country, a small war, he wanted to be sure that the ceasefire line was not on his. Maybe we could go through that. And the Shah explained his philosophy of the military plan. As you recall, he started what was called the White Revolution at the beginning of the 1960s. And he had 12 major fields that he was going to have his country advance on a broad plot. Land reform, education, medical science, sanitation, industrialization, a lot of things. The military was not one of them. The military, as he saw it, was the protection element that permits all of these other things to advance without outside influence. So the military was not one of the major advancement things. It was a catalyst or the stability that permitted the others to go. So he felt the military had to be strong enough to do, like they put him on the door, and I was wrong. These two basic things. He said, if I have to fight with a neighbor, I know Casey's wrong because they've been fighting with Iraq a long time. He said, but if I have to fight with a neighbor, I know the great powers are going to step in and stop it. I want my armed forces to be strong enough to absolutely assure me that the ceasefire line will not be on my side of the border. I will not be in Iranian territory to a nation anywhere near my side. We get back to that point. The other point was, if Russia decides to invade my country, I know I will never be able to be strong enough to stop it. Therefore, I must be strong enough to delay them enough to permit us a complete He said, if Russia comes in, they will get nothing of that. They will be supposed to. And he convinced his people of that. They knew that was the fact in their mind. Now, let's talk just a moment. You know, I cannot make this too long because it could get one more. Why did he feel that he might have to fight for the name? Almost 100 years ago, a Britisher was drawing a map. And he drew the boundary between Iraq and Iran. Internationally, if there is a mountain range or a river or something like that as a boundary, the line is drawn so that both nations can use the river. The river